that to mark the very first one off-site, I have the honor and pleasure of welcoming our first speaker, the former Prime Minister of Canada, the Right Honourable Joe Clark. Mr. Clark will be delivering a presentation entitled Canada's Assets in a Post-American World. Mr. Clark was elected 8 times to the House of Commons, serving as Prime Minister, Foreign Minister, Minister of Constitutional Affairs, and in several other senior positions. He has a long-standing personal and professional interest in Africa. In fact, he was just saying he just returned from South Africa this last week, and was the first and longest-serving chairman of the Commonwealth Committee of Foreign Ministers on Southern Africa, and was instrumental in mounting global pressure to end apartheid. He has been a visiting scholar at the University of California in Berkeley, American University in Washington, D.C., and the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He is currently professor of practice for public-private sector partnerships in the Center for Developing Area Studies, McGill Universities. The Right Honorable Joe Clark is a member of the Global Leadership Foundation, the Inter-America Dialogue, and the Council Center for International Governance Innovations. Please join me in welcoming the first of our speakers. Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you, Ruth, and ladies and gentlemen, let me express appreciation to McGill as well for hosting this and to you for attending. I'll keep a very close eye on that that orange flag. Since we're under a time limit, I'm not going to tell jokes, so any of you who came here for my jokes, I'm afraid that we'll have to wait later on. I'm going to speak briefly today about changes in international relations which offer, in my view, unusual opportunities for Canada and for the McGill Institute for the Study of International Development. These opportunities lie chiefly in fields where, for decades now, Canadian investment has been standing still or moving back, fields of diplomacy and of development. In Canada, 3 government departments have explicit international vocations. In 2008-2009, the budget of the Department of National Defense increased by close to 8.4%. The budget of the Canadian International Development Agency increased by 0.68%. The budget of Foreign Affairs and International Trade dropped by 17.96%. DFAT, Foreign Affairs, estimates that this decline will continue for at least the next 2 years, and that by 2010-2011, its budget will decrease by another 13.38%. Now, other countries had also cut spending on diplomacy and development, but many of those countries have begun deliberately to invest again in diplomacy and development because they believe that is in their national interest in the new world that is taking shape. That was Hillary Clinton's first announcement on her first day of office as Secretary of State of the United States. But look also at the diplomatic strength of Brazil and of China. Look at the high priority given diplomacy and development by, among others, Singapore, Norway, which consistently now undertakes the kinds of initiatives once associated with Canada. Interesting new entries like Qatar in the Gulf, and as usual, Britain and France. Canada has increased significantly our defense spending, arguing that for too long we had let other countries carry an increasing share of our defense burden. But our diplomatic and our development resources are being run down now as steadily and as certainly as our defense resources were run down before. One question is, why the double standard? But another question is one of timing. Why on earth would Canada do that now, when the changes in the world make our diplomatic and development credentials more valuable than they have ever been before? I'd ask you to think back to the last great change in international relations. The end of the Cold War. That end of the Cold War overturned the fundamental dynamics of foreign policy in Western countries. Despite high hopes, the new priority did not become a peace dividend or international development. Instead, it became trade and economic growth. Governments chose to believe that trade would combat poverty, that market models would release energies which were inherently democratic, and that military force could contain local challenges and disorders. The twin failures of the military intervention in Iraq and the collapse of the financial system demonstrate the limitations of that faith. At the same time, power in the world has been shifting inexorably. Economic power, cultural power, political power, and even military power. In his book, The Post-American World, Fareed Zakaria argues that this is not about any nation's decline. Rather, it is about the rise and the assertion of new forces. Sometimes when one looks at these changes, one's tempted to look at what countries ahead. Well, look, this isn't a horse race among megapowers. There are new forces in play, and they affect everyone. I would argue that the most notable change in this modern world is in where conflict comes from. Now, the most serious conflicts flow not from ideology and not merely from poverty, but from culture and identity and faith. Clearly, those conflicts cannot be resolved by mere military power or by the so-called magic of the market. They require a much greater reliance on political talents, the ability to draw differences together, to manage and respect diversity, and to earn and generate trust. Those qualities have always been valuable, but they have now become indispensable international attributes, and they will continue to be for the foreseeable future. They are also among the traditional and the genuine signature qualities of Canada, rooted in both our own history and, I should say, in our own present as a strikingly successful multicultural society. There is not a more successful multicultural society in the world, and they are reflected and rooted in our conduct historically in the world. Mediation and respect and reasonable compromise are at the heart of the success of our own diverse, dynamic country. They are an integral part of our international reputation and identity, and they are a credential which few other countries can claim. Why do we not treat that credential as a leading Canadian asset? Think of this in another way. If our international policy continues to concentrate so narrowly on trade and security, where will that take Canada? Goldman Sachs has published a careful projection of the changes in world economic standing by 2050. This slide indicates the world today, in 2007, where OECD countries dominate the top 10 largest economies. This is the world, a projection, only a projection, but not drawn out of the air, a careful projection by Goldman Sachs. This is the world in 2050. In 2050, the BRICS and the N11 will dominate. There will be a profound change. So in this world of shifting power, how long would Canada have a place at the table of a G8 summit if a G8 continued in place? Would we make the cut of a G20? In other words, would we keep our seat in the inner circle of countries which define international trade and military and diplomatic and development policy? Well, the answer is no, if we focus narrowly on trade or economic policy, or if we define our international profile by military presence. But the odds are that we could increase our influence as a country, we could increase our value as a society, were we to renew our trusted activist, diplomatic, and development credentials. For all our growth and innovation, Canada can have relatively more influence in politics and diplomacy than we do in trade and economics. Economic power reflects size. Diplomacy depends more on imagination and agility and reputation. Canada's political strengths have more currency again, if we choose to use them. Now, I argue that there is another growing advantage for Canada if we look at the emerging world with fresh eyes. The shift in power is not simply among nations. It is from nations to other forces. Some of the most decisive sources of change in the modern world are not nations at all. They're movements which arise and operate beyond the control of nation states. That includes the critical threats to international order now, which are rooted in culture and identity and which report to no capital. But it also includes profound improvements in the modern world which have been stimulated by initiatives from outside formal government, the environmental movement, the Grameen Bank, innumerable NGOs, the Gates and Comparable Foundations, the new commitment to corporate responsibility. Taken together, these constitute a powerful new source of innovation and experience, imaginative, respected, not bound by protocol, not confined by national interest. Yet here's the rub. For all these private or non-government initiatives, this is still an institutional world. Sovereign states still make the critical decisions to cut or to increase budgets, to respect or break treaties, to send or withdraw troops, to pay or withhold their membership fees, to confront or ignore crises. So the challenge and the opportunity now is to marry mandate with imagination, to combine the creativity of these independent forces with the capacity to act of institutions. That is very familiar territory to Canadians, because partnerships like that are what happened, for example, in the Commonwealth campaign against apartheid. They're what happened in the negotiation of the Landmines Treaty. They're what happened in the negotiation of the International Criminal Court, and in a wide range of less publicized initiatives. We all know the world is changing. We also know the instinct within most nations to see things narrowly or defensively. We know the need for decision makers from profoundly different perspectives to find a place and an incentive to find what Mr. Gorbachev, in an earlier era of change, called new thinking. The Institute for the Study of International Development doesn't have a motto, but if it sought one, new thinking would serve. I have to add this, new thinking and new acting. Let me parse the title of our seminar, Citizen-Centered and Development. Ask yourself why development is now not funded adequately in Canada, or indeed in most of the rich world. One of the main reasons is precisely that policy making in those democracies, the rich democracies, has become more citizen-centered. Public opinion matters more, and citizens of most rich countries don't know enough about international development to support it, so their governments don't. Advocates of development and organizations like ISID have to focus much more on the kind of education and constituency building which will influence citizen-centered decisions in our own democracies. Otherwise, we think and we propose in a vacuum. The world thinks very well of Canada. Our leadership, our initiatives, can be influential. Rather than simply being, and I don't disparage the term, rather than simply being thought leaders, we can be action leaders. The BBC regularly publishes an international survey by the polling firm GlobeScan, which lists several countries and asks a broadly based international sample of 28,000 respondents around the world if each of those countries had, in the question, a mostly positive or a mostly negative impact on the world. Their most recent poll was in January 2009. Usually Canada is at the top of the list. Germany, for some reason, has moved ahead of us. But we have consistently, since this kind of polling began, and it's quite rigorous polling, but we have consistently been the country that was regarded as being as having a mainly positive, as distinct from a mainly negative image in the world. That means that Canada has an unusual opportunity for influence and for impact. And that is all the more the case in a world where the principal challenge is to manage conflicts among cultures and where there is a growing need to marry the innovation and imagination of non-state actors with the mandate and the capacity to act of national governments. Our success in encouraging and managing diversity at home and the high reputation that we have earned through six decades at least of active internationalism are assets which in this emerging world can be as valuable to Canada as our natural resource wealth. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Clark. I think the other two speakers will notice that the orange didn't even have to come out, so we're leaving lots of time for discussion.